Psalm 85. You showed favor to your land, O Lord. You restored the fortunes of Jacob. You forgave the iniquity of your people and covered all their sins. You set aside all your wrath and turned from your fierce anger. Restore us again, O God, our Savior, and put away your displeasure toward us. Will you be angry with us forever? Will you prolong your anger through all generations? Will you not revive us again, that your people may rejoice in you? Show us your unfailing love, O Lord, and grant us your salvation. I will listen to what God the Lord will say. He promises peace to his people, his saints. But let them not return to folly. Surely his salvation is near those who fear him, that his glory may dwell in our land. Love and faithfulness meet together. Righteousness and peace kiss each other. Faithfulness springs forth from the earth, and righteousness looks down from heaven. The Lord will indeed give what is good, and our land will yield its harvest. Righteousness goes before him and prepares the way for his steps. This is the word of the Lord.
Keep that open. We've already prayed for God to speak to us, so I won't add another prayer. Go straight in. When I was little, all those years ago, there used to be a children's program called Play School, sort of about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And probably the only other person in the church family who remember Play School is Claire Hochschild, and she's not here today. You remember Play School? The Australian version. Did you have the window? You know, at a certain point in the program, there were a range of windows in the studio. There's the square one, and the round one, and the oval one, and whatever else, triangular one. It's all to teach you things, you know, teach you shapes. And at a certain stage in the program, they say, now, which window are we going to go through today? We're going to go through the round window. And the camera zooms in, takes you through the window into some wonderful panorama somewhere outside the studio, usually outside in the country somewhere, where some recording had been done of something which was going to teach us, whatever it might be. Well, that hasn't got a lot to do with today's passage, except that it kept coming to my mind as I was preparing, not because of some escapist tendency that as I was preparing the sermon, I was wanting to disappear out the window to some sort of pleasant panorama beyond. But sometimes when you're looking at a passage, you find that there's a particular verse which is a bit like a window into sort of understanding the whole passage. And if you can sort of get through that window, it sort of all opens up the inner workings of the passage like a panorama. In case of Psalm 85, I found that to be very true of verse 6. Will you not revive us again, that your people may rejoice in you? It's slightly more complicated in this sense, I think, because it's a sort of a double window, a top and a bottom. It's got two halves, and each half goes through and leads us out into a different panorama that we're going to think about now. And let's start with, say, that the bottom half, if we go through that, the camera goes through, it's that wibbly-wobbly bit on the screen, and we come out and we see a new panorama. And the first thing we see or hear about, I think, is a man who has known better days. The word again is the key there in the first half of the verse. Will you not revive us again? Literally, will you not give us life again? It tells us that it's happened once before, and that what's happened before needs to happen once again. You don't ask someone to revive you if you're feeling full of life and full of beans and everything's fine. And if we glance back to 1 to 3, we get a sense of how things used to be. The psalmist remembers those better days when the Lord showed favor to them, when they felt and experienced the Lord's favor. You showed favor to your land, O Lord. You restored the fortunes of Jacob. And that's the panorama that's beginning to open up before us, the land. It's a panorama of fertile fields ready for harvest, of orchards laden with fruit, of animals munching contentedly, fat and ready for the butcher, or whatever might come next. Perhaps not so romantic if you're one of the animals. You forgive, there's that picture in the first half or in the beginning of verse 1, showing favour to the land and so on. And then that favour is experienced not just in material blessings of the land and so on, but in these other scenes in 2 and 3 which describe the spiritual blessing, and that's what I talked about in the children's talk. Sin being lifted off, sin being covered over, the wrath being set aside, God turning away from his anger. It's all speaking of that key relationship at the heart of the universe, actually, and the key relationship at the heart of our lives between us and God. The psalmist remembers the joy of knowing his sins had been forgiven, of the relationship being restored. He remembers the relief of knowing that he had nothing more to fear from God. And he had good memories of how things had once been. The favor of God, the forgiveness that he gave, and the peace that came from that. But that's the problem. This scene, this panorama, it's all memories. And it's a million miles from his current experience. That's why he's praying as he is. Will you not revive us again? And it's not just his own problem, it's a church problem as well. Because others of God's people are finding themselves in the same situation. The prayer in 4 and 5 and 6 is not for me, but for us. Restore us again. Put away your displeasure towards us. Will you not revive us again? They feel that they're no longer on the receiving end of the Lord's favor, but actually on the receiving end of his displeasure. They feel they're under the cloud of his displeasure, not the sunshine of his forgiveness. And that experience of his unfailing love, well, that's a bit of a distant dream. They wonder if that salvation they thought they had received was the real thing, or maybe it was just a mirage. It seems so far away. And so they pray for its return, verse 7. Show us your unfailing love, O Lord, and grant us your salvation. They've experienced it before, but somehow it feels absent now. So the whole psalm is a heart cry from a man whose present experience is that God is far away, not near to him. Now, various suggestions have been made as to when this particular psalm was written and what particular situation it was that God's people were in at this time. There are all sorts of possibilities it could be from the Old Testament history of Israel. And in a sense, I think that's the point. There are all sorts of possibilities. It's not tied down to a particular episode, because this is an experience that individual believers and the church, God's people, have gone through again and again in history, and still do go through today. It's part of the ever-repeating experience of God's people. And if we stop to think, probably the words of the psalmist find an echo in most of our own experiences. If we've been a Christian for more than a few years, we've known times when we've experienced God's favor, perhaps particularly intensely for a season. And we've known times when the Lord feels distant, when his blessings seem far from us. Those first few verses, verses 2 and 3 especially, could be expressing the experience of the new believer, full of that first joy of salvation, reveling in the wonder of being forgiven, of being at peace with God again. But weeks and months and years pass, and even the most zealous new believer loses that initial joy. But those same verses could also be expressing the experience of someone who's lived much longer as a Christian, but Scott has come to a point where the memory of those blessings has dimmed. So is that normal? Is that part of the normal struggle, part of the ups and downs of life in this world? Sometimes that is the case, but here it's a more serious situation. It's because he's got stuck, he's come to a standstill in his Christian life, and he's experiencing not just that he can't feel God's presence, but he actually knows, when he's honest with himself, that he's under God's displeasure. And it's all made worse because he can't just remember, he's not only remembering what things used to be like, but he also has a strong sense of how things ought to be. That's the second thing we find when we go through the, if you like, the top half of the window. A man who knows how life is meant to be. And I'm picking up there the second half of that verse 6, that your people may rejoice in you. And that's meant to be the hallmark of God's people. That's the built-in default option we all are born again with. People who radiate the joy because we are actively in possession of all those blessings from verses 1 to 3. That's what life is meant to be like for today followers of Christ. And as we read on to the last four verses of the psalm, another panorama unfolds before our eyes. So we go through the window and the wibbly-wobbly bit, and what comes now into focus. In a way, it's like a poem in the form of a painting. The psalmist takes four of the primary characteristics of the Lord: his love, his faithfulness, his righteousness, his peace. And to make them come alive for us, he paints them into his panorama, but as figures, almost like they're human figures walking across the canvas that he's painting here. These characteristics are so much distinctive characteristics of God that Hebrew has almost a special God word for all of them, words which we can't quite sum up in any single word in English. When it speaks of his love, it's his unfailing love, steadfast love, not quite the same as the fickle, I can't think of the German for that, the ever-changing human version. Faithfulness, well, we know a bit about that, but God's faithfulness involves absolute truth in all he says, absolute reliability in sticking to whatever he promises. And the righteousness is not just a commitment to do what is right and just, but being active in doing it, being at work to make things right, and especially that righteousness word includes making people right with God. And peace, as many of you will know, that's the Hebrew word shalom. And we often use that word in English because there isn't an English word which sums up all that that refers to. Well-being, wholeness, all the fullness of the blessings that God intends us to experience, how things ought to be. And so the psalmist takes these four characteristics as characters, as people you can see walking around in this panorama. Love and faithfulness are seen going for a walk together, enjoying one another's company. Verse 10, love and faithfulness meet together. Righteousness and peace are seen greeting one another tenderly, delighting to be together. Righteousness and peace kiss each other. And in another part of the tableau, we see a figure springing up from the ground, and that turns out to be faithfulness again, skipping and dancing with joy and delight through the countryside. Faithfulness springs from the earth. And up perhaps a distant figure up in the heavens, perhaps almost out of range of sight. A figure beams down on the earth, filled with harmony. That's God's righteousness looking down from heaven. And that panorama, I suppose, in a way, is a poetic description of the end of verse 9. You see, it says that his glory may dwell in our land. That's part of his prayer and longing. But what does that mean when you stop to think about it? What will it mean to have God's glory dwelling in the land? Well, in a way, that sort of picture, the poetry in visual form of 10 to 13, tells you a bit about what it would be like. Actually, it tells you a little bit about what it was like when God's glory was on earth in Jesus Christ, when love and faithfulness met together, when righteousness and peace kissed each other, and so on. And God's glory was seen as fully as was possible in this world. And of course, it's true that that wonderful picture, that panorama, will never be the case short of Christ's return. It's a picture of the ideal new world that will only exist when God's kingdom is fully established. We live in the non-ideal reality of a world which is at war with Christ's kingdom. So we shouldn't get our hopes up that we'll find ourselves dancing mitt with faithfulness and righteousness and so on anytime soon. And yet, nevertheless, we are encouraged to believe that our experience here in this world will have some similarities to the full experience in heaven. Our experience now will at least have a similar shape and a similar flavour to the fullness which we will one day experience. We should at least have some understanding and fellow feeling as to why those figures in the tableau are so filled with joy. I suppose you might say we should at least have a walk-on part in this panorama at times in our lives. And that's been the experience of God's people down the ages. A joy about salvation and being forgiven that is constantly being refreshed and deepened. A glimpse from time to time of the fullness of joy which lies in store for us. Just a glimpse. And sometimes that glimpse, that foretaste of the great glory, it comes in quiet ways as God's mercies wash over us afresh. And sometimes it comes more powerfully, and the waves of God's mercies don't just wash gently over us. They knock us off our feet. Sometimes that happens not just to individuals, but to God's people as a whole in an area, to a whole church or a group of churches. It's times like that, which we call times of revival, evekum, when the Lord does his restoring and refreshing and renewing work, his always work, which he's always doing, but there are times when he does that with particular power and intensity. And when that happens, not just on an individual level, but amongst a group or in an area all at one time, that's what we tend to call revival. It's not something that it's given to all Christians to experience. That is something we should long and pray for. The problem of the believer in this psalm is not that he's going through one of those tough times, which are just part of the normal ups and downs of the Christian life. His problem is he's in these circumstances through his own fault. He's under God's displeasure. He's under God's anger, as we've seen. That's the reason why he's where he is, under a cloud, not in the sunshine. So he's a man who's known better times. He's a man who knows how life is meant to be. And perhaps deep down there is that longing in him to experience a reviving work of God. And he knows that his current experience falls short And he knows that it's his fault and his problem. So a key question this psalm poses for us is, first of all, are we in his situation? And we're in this series of called Times of Refreshing, look at a number of Bible passages, and it's not a coincidence that it's during Lent, the Fastensite, the time in the church's year when we particularly reflect and take stock and look inward and examine ourselves and say, well, where am I with God? Are there things I need to do to put things right, to get back close to him? Some of us may want to spend some time looking back. Compare how things are now with how things once were. And perhaps remembering what it was like when we did last experience the joy of our salvation, and perhaps realize we need to recapture that scene described in verses 2 and 3. Some of us may want to find it more profitable to look ahead and to study that tableau in verses 10 to 13, that second panorama, and ask ourselves, well, does it excite me that that's our destination? And does it fill me with a longing to experience more and more of that divine favour now in the present? Just read the first paragraph of a chapter from this book, Revival Sent from God, which is what I'm basing some of these sermons on. I think there's still copies of this left on the bookstall if you want to buy them. For those of us who have been Christians for a while, it becomes easy to think that we've pretty much exhausted the possibilities of the Christian life. We can settle into a routine of activities at church, in our small groups and Bible studies, with little expectation of anything new. The familiar becomes the predictable. And everything from here on will be more of the same. And here's a great little illustration, a picture for you. We dip our teaspoon into the vast ocean of the living God. Holding that teaspoon in our hand, we say, this is my experience of God. We pour it out into our lives and we say, this is the Christian experience. But God calls us to dive into the ocean. He calls us into ever new regions of his fullness, his immensity, his all-sufficiency. There is more for us in Christ than we have yet apprehended or taken on board. First question we may need to ask ourselves, are we in the situation of this psalmist? Not where we ought to be. And secondly, if the answer to that is no, we're not where we ought to be, and we are in his situation, well, what can we do about it? Two things. We need to turn back to the Lord. Verses 8 to 9 are a sort of bridge between the distance from God, which he describes in verses 4 to verse 7, being under displeasure and so on, and that wonderful panorama at the end there. What is it that will get the psalmist from this place of displeasure to life as it ought to be? Well, he needs to listen. I will listen to what God the Lord will say. He promises peace to his people, his saints, but let them not return to folly. So it's a resolve, a renewed, a revived resolve. I will listen. Not to, I'm going to listen sometime, but I will, like the I will, the determined I will of the wedding service. And he's going to have nothing to do with the folly of turning a deaf ear to God. If you like, he looks forward to the relationship being revived, being reset. We need to turn back to the Lord if that's our situation. But our problem is we can't carry that through in our own strength. So actually we need this second thing. We need the Lord to turn back to us. The root Hebrew word turn is used several times in this passage. Like the word restore is actually literally turn the fortunes of Jacob. Verse 4, turn us again, O God, our Saviour. We need God to turn us, but the sense in which we also need God to turn back towards us. And that's really what he's asking for in verse 6. That God would turn to his people again, that he would revive us again, that he would do that work in us which we cannot do in ourselves, so that we can rejoice in him again as we're meant to. So will that be our prayer this Lenten season as we head towards our reminder of Christ's death and resurrection and all that he's done for us? Will that be our prayer individually and as a church family? Will you not revive us again, that your people may rejoice in you? If you want to put the next song up, it's really a very prayerful song. Musicians might like to start getting ready. It's a song you may want to sing prayerfully for yourself. It may be something that you can't yet sing, that you need to reflect more before you sing it. Have a look at the words for a few minutes first. Is this what we want God to do in us? You may want to pray it quietly in your heart. You might want to sing with. You might want just to reflect as others of us sing. Feel free to stand or sit or kneel or as you like for this, and we'll just sing it through prayerfully, asking God.